Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining Pain and MS. Your host for today is Ms. Alicia Barron. Ms. Barron, you may begin.
Great. Thank you so much. And thank you, everyone, for joining us tonight. I'm really thrilled with the response that we received to this teleconference. I can tell that this is a subject that's of interest to many of you. And so I'm so glad you were able to join us. And we're really also thrilled to have Dr. Heidi Maloney joining us for this call. Dr. Maloney has spoken on this topic for other chapters of the National MS Society and came very, very highly recommended. So I'm really excited to hear her presentation, and I'm sure you all are as well. One quick announcement, because we did have a really great response to this teleconference, unfortunately we won't be able to accommodate the traditional question and answer at the end of the session. So I'm sure I notified you guys of email, if you had email, that this would be happening, and I've gotten some great questions via email. And so I will be asking some of those questions that I received at the end of the presentation and having a short discussion with Dr. Maloney. But if you have any questions that aren't answered within the slides, which I will tell you the slides are wonderful, I think most of the questions will get answered. But if for some reason we don't answer your question, I want you to please invite you to email me or call me, or if you even call our 800 number, they can get me the question that you have. And I will try to get you the answer either from Dr. Maloney or from one of our other resources and provide you with an answer. So I'm sorry that we're not able to do that, but unfortunately, just with this many people on the call, it really wouldn't be fair to only be able to get to about five questions, and that's it. So Dr. Maloney, I want to thank you again so much for joining us. We're so excited for your presentation, and if you wouldn't mind telling us a little bit about yourself and getting started, we would appreciate that.
Well, thank you, Alicia, and welcome to everybody. Pain in MS is difficult, and if you're out there listening to this conference and you are dealing with the symptom of pain, you can readily agree to that. So my title is I am the National Clinical Nursing Director of the MS Center of Excellence in the Veterans Affairs Medical System. So that's kind of a big, huge title, but what it means is that I take care of veterans with multiple sclerosis here in the VA. And I've been in the field of MS for years and years, like maybe longer than some of you have been born, like over 30, in the field of MS since the 70s when I started working at the NIH. Pain became a special emphasis for me because I grew up in the years when pain was not considered a symptom of multiple sclerosis, and that was in the 80s. Neurologists would say to patients, nope, there is no such thing as pain. But let's just get into our talk, because we've got a lot to talk about together tonight. I have a lot to discuss with you, and the first slide says, Pain in MS, a biopsychosocial approach to management. And that means that pain is more than something physical. And that is the gist of our conversation tonight. So the next slide is going to talk about the objectives I want to discuss with you. I want to talk to you about understanding the nature of pain in MS, what it is. How do you distinguish a pain that comes from MS, and how do you distinguish pain that might be coming from something physical? To describe the pain in multiple sclerosis, just like I mentioned, to recognize self-management strategies that you can employ to get on top of your pain, and then discuss the pharmacologic and non-pharmacologic pain management strategies. Okay? So let's begin with the next slide. It talks a bit about pain in MS and what we know. Pictured on this slide, and let me back up and tell you that if you don't have the slides, you can email to Alicia or to me, and she can share my email and give her permission to do that, and I can send these slides to you. So if you're sitting there without a computer and you don't happen to see the slides, but on this slide, there is a photograph of Charcot. Now, he is considered the father of MS because this is the French neurologist back in the 1800s that described the triad of poor speech and poor walking and poor eyesight, the three things that came together to to describe what he called insular sclerosis, and he developed that idea. But the interesting thing is that Charcot had a housekeeper who had this triad of symptoms, and he wanted her to live in with him so that he could watch her over time. And do you know what he found out with seeing her? That she experienced pain. So he described that back in the 1800s, although it wasn't necessarily thought of at that time as one of the bigger symptoms of MS. But guess what? 20% of folks who come to the neurologist for the first time with their very first symptom come with the symptom of pain. 20% of people who are later than diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. 50% of all folks with MS at any given time will complain of a pain syndrome. And in a certain study done by a neurologist named O'Connor, he saw that 75% of patients in his survey had pain in the past 3 preceding months. So pain is definitely exists as a symptom. Pain is associated with some particular things, particularly older age. Folks complain of greater pain, longer disease duration. And that makes sense. Because if you can imagine sitting in wheelchairs for a period of time, you know, the pain on your bottom, the pain of needing to drag your leg through your gait, all of those greater disabilities can bespeak pain. Also, pain in several studies was associated with lower education level. Interesting. I don't know if I buy that. Greater duration of pain. People with greater duration of pain seem to have more pain. People who experience pain in the past seem to have greater pain. And that makes sense in a way, because you always fear and are more anxious over when is that pain going to happen if you've experienced it in the past. Increased disability, as I stated, musculoskeletal pain exists, a progressive disease course. Depression, mental health impairments, all are risk factors for developing multiple sclerosis pain. And being female is a risk factor for developing MS pain, interestingly. More females in studies have been noted with headache pain. Now, the next slide talks about the pain experience in MS and looks at the psychosocial and psychological factors, which we will discuss later in the talk, that have a great impact more so than any other variable on pain intensity. This was found in 4 or 5 different studies of MS pain. They found pain in MS was associated with greater anxiety, associated with depression, associated with increased fatigue and increased concentration and memory problems. The greatest pain syndromes that were experienced in folks with MS were continuous burning in the extremities, kind of that burning or aching someone might get on the tops of their feet, in the backs of their thighs that radiates up their buttocks and maybe into the back. Headache pain, back pain, and painful tonic spasms, which I will discuss and define in a bit, were the most common pain syndromes. Research has shown that pain in MS is insufficiently treated, and those that experience pain have greater healthcare utilization. Well, that's a duh, because frankly, if you feel like your pain is not well treated, you're going to be at the doctor's door more often. The next slide gives a couple of definitions of pain. And the first definition there says that pain is an individualistic, physiologic, learned, and social response to noxious stimuli. That's a very interesting definition, because it treats pain as a disease and not a symptom. This definition assumes really a biopsychosocial approach to the management of pain, because it's individual. For each person, pain can be different. It can be physiological, a sensory experience, and also a learned and social response. Very interesting definition. The second definition I also like, it's pain is an unpleasant, sensory, emotional experience associated with actual or potential tissue damage and described in terms of such damage. A pain specialist, Mirsky and Bob Duke, back in 1994, developed that definition of pain, which does treat pain as a disease. But pain, my favorite definition is on the next slide, my absolute favorite definition, because it's so true. pain is whatever the experiencing person says it is existing whenever they say it does. Now, that definition came from a nurse. And I'm a nurse, even though I was called Dr. Maloney. That means I have a PhD. That's not my background, really. My background is that I am a nurse, and nurses come from a very different perspective. Nurses are the folks that you can sit with in the office visit and really pour your heart out and discuss things and get some answers, I hope. So nurses do say, McCaffrey, who developed this definition of pain as a nurse back in 1984, she said, it's whatever the person says it is. So the next slide. In MS, what do we know about pain in MS? Well, you know, frankly, it's a mixed bag. Pain can be coming from two different areas. Pain can be musculoskeletal, or it can come from a lesion in the central nervous system. So let's go back to the musculoskeletal kind of pain. That pain is called nociceptive, and that's really referring to the neurotransmitters that are under the skin that are experiencing either a noxious, and when I say noxious, I mean not normal and certainly not nice, either a mechanical, a thermal, a chemical, or electrical stimulation that sets up nerve fiber generation to the brain to say, hey, something hurts here. So in MS, you know, I mentioned before, that can hurt from sitting long time in one position, lying in bed and not being able to move. You're going to start feeling your heels hurting on the bottom of the bed. You're going to start feeling the hurting of your elbows, so that shearing of elbows as you try to push yourself off. Walking with forearm canes, walking with a cane, trying to swing a leg, as I mentioned before, through a gate. All of that is mechanical, physical pain that's frankly related to your multiple sclerosis, but not pain coming from a lesion in the central nervous system. So your MS symptoms are coming from lesions in the central nervous system. Your neurologist does an MRI, and he's looking at those lesions or spots. Sometimes I call them UBOs, unidentified bright objects. So all of those little spots in your brain are indications of a transgression in the nerves not making a smooth connection. So the neurogenic pain experienced in MS is either discussed by patients as intermittent or steady, spontaneous or evoked. So let me describe that. Steady pain that's there all the time, never really goes away, pretty much always there, is described as burning, tingling, aching, throbbing. And an example of this, and I'll use a $4 word, it's called dysesthetic. It just means pain that's abnormal. Extremity pain, it's typically pain that's in the arms and legs. Now, the intermittent pain comes and goes, and it's described as shooting, stabbing, electric knife-like, searing. And an example of that kind of pain is the pain of trigeminal neuralgia. So in the very next slide, I talk about the intermittent, another word for that is paroxysmal MS pain syndromes. And the first one on the list is trigeminal neuralgia. Now, that pain can be evoked. It can be evoked or stimulated by a breeze that occurs. Now, trigeminal neuralgia occurs in the face. There are three branches of the trigeminal nerve that innervate the face, and one of them is above the eyes on the forehead, one of them is at the cheek, and one of them kind of juts down below on the chin. So any area of that trigeminal nerve can be affected. And research and MRIs have shown us that there is a lesion, typically in the pons, which is the brainstem, that generates that pain response. So it's fairly prevalent in multiple sclerosis, up to 5%, and it's 20 times more common in MS than in the general population. Typically, it's on one side of the face, but in as many as 30% of folks, it can be bilateral on both sides of the face. Now, I said it was evoked. It can be evoked by chewing, by speaking, by brushing teeth, by eating, well, that's chewing, by a soft wind on the face. So folks may be keeping their faces very rigid when this pain occurs. It may last for a second up to over a minute and then goes away. But it is excruciating, this kind of pain. It can occur several times in a day. It can occur once and never occur again for another month. So it's very erratic. Now, glossopharyngeal neuralgia is the next pain syndrome that's intermittent. It's fairly rare. And I use the word lancinating, which is really stabbing, excessive pain in the back of the throat, in the back of the tongue, in the tonsils in that area. Again, very rare. Episodic facial pain, another MS pain syndrome, is dull on the face. It's nearly continuous. It does come and go, though. It's not well defined. It can be it can be triggered. It can be episodic and relate to triggers like chewing. Some researchers have thought that this is a prelude or a forebearer of trigeminal neuralgia. The next pain syndrome that's common, that's intermittent, is paroxysmal limb pain. So the coming and going, that's what paroxysmal means, intermittent. It occurs as a painful tonic spasm. You can see it in folks that might have spasms and their legs will jerk out for absolutely no reason. It's triggered also, triggered by touch, by movement, by hyperventilating, by emotions, may occur several times in a day and last for greater than a minute. That should be a greater sign there. It usually lasts less than a minute, so the slide is absolutely correct, less than 2 minutes. So it's not long-lasting, but it can be very painful when it occurs. Another type of limb pain can be seizure-like pain of an arm where it's contracted in, or the wrist is contracted in, or the fingers are contracted for a short period of time, a minute or less. It's described as seizure activity because it comes and goes, but it's not really a seizure, occurring in about 11 to 17% of patients. Headache. Headache occurs as an intermittent pain syndrome in MS. It's recognized more in MS than in the general population. The prevalence, meaning anytime we look out there in the field of multiple sclerosis, there'll be up to 34% of folks experiencing headache. Happens more in women than in men. The headaches are of all types. They may be tension headaches, vascular headaches, cluster headaches, and those headaches, when they do some MRI scans, are related to lesions in the pons. Also, migraine occurs in 22% of folks with multiple sclerosis, three times greater than in the general population. So headaches really are associated with MS, and to show that they're associated is that relationship between lesions in the pons and folks that have headaches. Another research study felt that headache in MS was related to a dysregulation of the serotonin norepinephrine neurotransmitter syndrome. So it was noted that, now this is one study, so please don't take this to the bank. You can never say that one study means that this is really true, but it does give us a suspicion that maybe we ought to dig deeper. So one study looked at this dysregulation and showed that folks with multiple sclerosis who experienced headache had less amounts of norepinephrine and serotonin. So those are feel-good neurotransmitters in our brain that help us feel good. And guess what? Medications with serotonin are those medications that are antidepressants. They're medications that work on migraine, like the triptan medications. So there may be very pathogenic, this kind of headache in MS. Then lastly on this list is Lhermitte's. It's kind of a coming and going of a sensation. When you dip your chin into your chest, you'll have an electric shock-like sensation down your back, maybe into your arm. That's experienced in about 40% of folks. It may be what sends people to the neurologist for a diagnosis of multiple sclerosis. It's a hypersensitivity of demyelinated cervical sensory axons to stretching. Okay, so let's go to the next slide. Steady MS pain syndromes. So what are those? Those are dysesthetic extremity pain, musculoskeletal pain, and painful tonic spasms, kind of what I described before. But these can also be steady of the spasms, because spasms are usually always there, the idea of spasticity, tonic, clonic movements of your limbs. So dysesthetic extremity pain is the most common chronic pain syndrome. can be described as burning, tingling, dull, nagging, prickling. It's worse at night, aggravated by changes of temperature, and worse after exercise. Clearly, exercise heats our bodies, and that may be because of that ambient change in temperature exacerbates this extremity pain. Ways of dealing with this pain can be with tricyclic antidepressant drugs that we'll talk about in a bit. Topical preparations like hot pepper, capsaicin, clonidine, warm and cold compresses, stockings, pressure stockings. Now, some folks with this extremity pain, any light touch can actually worsen the pain. So you want to keep bedclothes off. You want to put shearling booties on so heels are not touching rough bedclothes, because that's going to make the pain worse. If the pain is not made worse by touch, it's possible that the warm and cold the pressure stockings, especially worn at night, may actually help. Any cutaneous stimulation like massage or cooling. Musculoskeletal pain. You know, make sure your pain is not just pain that's coming from MS. Your pain could be back pain. You could have a slipped disc. So not all pain is necessarily related to multiple sclerosis. Even though I said musculoskeletal pain can come from living a long time with MS and the disability associated. But always check out with your doc, what is the source of that pain? Is it stress on bones and joints and muscles? Is it because of immobility and inactivation? Is it because you're using compensatory muscles? Is it because you've got osteoporosis and that induces little fine hairline fractures? Is it because of a degenerative joint disease? Some folks with multiple sclerosis talk to me about joint pain. They say, gosh, I have joint pain, and I'm seeing that more, but you know, there's nothing out in the literature about joint pain. Now, arthritis is very different than some of the joint pain. Arthritis is a disease all of itself and can be rheumatoid or osteoarthritis, and I can talk about a little bit about that later. If I don't stop talking, if I keep talking, I'll never get through all these slides, right? And we do want to do that. So I also want you to be aware of something called avascular necrosis. This is a wearing away of the bone of the hip or large joint related to lack of blood supply to that joint. How does that happen? It happens because of steroid use. It can happen at one dose of steroids or many doses of steroids. It may never happen, so don't panic. If you're on, you know, pulse steroids every month, it's not necessarily going to happen that you have avascular necrosis. You know, I actually don't have a statistic on how common that is, but if you have joint pain or hip pain, have an MRI done. MRI, best modality for recognizing avascular necrosis. Let's go on to the next pain. Step one is assessment. Identify the hurt. Where is that hurt? When does it happen? What are the characteristics? Is it burning? Is it aching? What does it feel like? And then what do you do to relieve that? What do you do to make it better? What do you do to make it worse? And write all that down and bring it to your doctor in a little diary so that he can see it. Think about the psychological factors that may be affecting your well-being. Are you anxious? Are you stressed? Are you depressed? Because the literature shows that those psychological factors will increase the experience of pain. Look at your social support, and I'm going to talk about that in a little bit. So the goals of pain management: think about your mood, your sleep, your function, and your quality of life. That's and I'm going to go to the next slide, because there's a pain effects scale that you can take yourself through. In the past 4 weeks, how much did pain interfere with your mood on a scale of 1 to 10? 1 being not at all, 5 being excruciating. I'm sorry, I said 1 to 10. I meant 1 to 5. 1 being nothing to 5 being the worst mood you've ever had, and you know, the other numbers being someplace in between. So how's it affect your sleep? Can you sleep or not sleep because you have pain? Can you even get to sleep because you have more pain at night? Your ability to move and walk around, your normal work, your recreation activities, and your enjoyment of life, your quality of life, how is that affected by your pain? And that's what you need to talk to your doctor about, because you need to do something about it. Now, there's a registry called NARCOMS that registers 24,000 actually registers lots of people with multiple sclerosis throughout the country. You can go on the website and look at NARCOMS. You're probably familiar with it. But self-report of pain validated by this pain effects scale was reported by 24,000 people that self-reported MS pain. That's amazing. I mean, that's a lot. So this pain effect scale is on the NARCOMS registry, and when people took the little assessment on the registry, 24,000 people said, yep, they've got pain. The next slide is just kind of what I've already told you about, the onset, location, duration, which is a good way to understand pain. I'm going to go to the next slide because pain is the fifth vital sign. And you know, when you go to the doctor, the nurse, when she does your vital signs, always says, well, what is your pain today on a scale of 1 to 10? Tell me, with 10 being the most excruciating. You may want to tell her it's 14. She'll keep you, or he, the nurse, will keep you to that 1 to 10 scale. Self-report of pain is the single most reliable indicator of pain. Some folks with some cognitive issues may find that the FACES scale is the best reliable. And you can see the FACES scale on this slide. No pain to that crying, excruciating pain. I'm just going to point out on the next slide is a brief pain inventory that your doctor may give you to fill out to better evaluate your pain. If that person doesn't give you that pain effect scale, print it out from this website and fill it out yourself and take it in. So let's get to pain experience. You know, pain is different for different patients, and that's what one of the definitions was, that it's individual. Different people experience pain on different levels to comparable stimuli. So as where I might feel a prick of a needle in a mild way, you might feel it in a very exaggerated way, and it's real for both of us, and it's meaningful for both of us. So how does that experience of pain differ? What are some of the factors that create a variable experience? Who you are, where you come from, your genetic makeup, your cultural experience, your religion, your energy level, your ability to cope with different things, prior pain experiences, all of these have variations in your ability to tolerate different levels of pain. Patients with chronic pain are more sensitive to pain and other stimuli. Now, our next slide talks about the sensory experience of pain. Pain is sensory, motivational, and cognitive experience, which, to my mind, validates this biopsychosocial model of pain. So what do I mean when I say sensory discriminative? Well, the brain receives a pain message. Say you put your hand on a hot stove, your finger on a hot stove, and your brain receives signals through your peripheral nervous system into the central nervous system, into the brainstem and the, you know, the midbrain, and into all the higher brain centers, and it registers the strength of that sensation, the intensity, where it is. It's on your thumb or your finger on the stove, and the spatial aspects of it, you know, the heat of it, the spatial, where it is, and then promptly a message comes back to take your finger off that stove, okay? So there's prompt withdrawal to that painful stimuli. So that's the sensory experience. It's physical. There's also a motivational affective experience of pain, and that's almost an instinctual experience we have. Like the turtle on the screen, you touch that top of the turtle and he instinctually brings his body into his shell. You do the same thing if you think about it. You want to guard if you have a hurt arm or a sore arm. You want to make sure no one bumps into that arm by taking the good arm and shielding the hurt arm. Your child falls down and scrapes his knee, the first thing you might do is you might want to kiss it. Do you think it made it better? Doggone right it made it better. Your child feels that warmth from you, the social support from you, and frankly the pain, even though he experiences the sensation of it, he or she experiences that sensation, it's less. It's not as intense. So our motivational effective self helps us with the intensity of the pain. So explaining this, our reticular activating system is the system in our brain that is the wake-up call that is important for recognizing pain, that helps protect our bodies from pain. Oh yeah, there's pain in this environment. It's the hot stove. Get ready to do something. Our limbic system helps us express how we're going to manage that pain. Are we going to curl up in a ball? Are we going to run into our bed, pull the covers over our head, and turn out the lights? Are we going to escape? What is going to be our reaction? So that's the motivational affective system. But you know what? The next slide will tell us that our cognitive evaluative system overrides all the rest. It blocks and modulates the experience of pain because of who we are and what we are used to be, how we're used to managing. So let me just illustrate. Our role may dictate how we experience the intensity of pain. Say you're building a treehouse with your kid and you whack your hammer with your, excuse me, you whack your thumb with the hammer. And say you're a guy. So you're a man. So you've got that dad role going on. If you're a mom, you might be able to cry a little, but a dad probably wouldn't cry. He probably, his cognitive evaluative experience, he might want to say, oh, shit. But he won't because he's with his kids. So his brain is going to override, excuse me if I offended anyone with that word. His brain is going to override even the profanity that he may want to elicit, because that's his cognitive evaluative self. He's going to override that. And he may actually, he may shake his hand. He may rub it, rubbing it. He may do all those things, but he certainly isn't going to experience quite the intensity because he's got his whole family around him to see how he performs his role. Okay? So culture, gender, experience, all of that is our cultural experience. Now let's go to the next slide. I want to talk about a couple of concepts here. Perceptual dominance is that our brain is capable of processing only so much information at a time. And this is important to recognize because we have one great pain experience, if we resolve that pain experience or modulate it, we may discover, oh my golly, our knees are killing us. And it's not that we are looking for more pain or we're malingerers or that there's more pain in our life and we only think of pain all the time. Nope, not at all. It's just that the worst pain was dominating those other pains that we might feel. So perceptual dominance is illustrated by the skeleton x-ray you see here that is an example of a carpenter who cut his hand off with a bandsaw when he was working on some wood project. And that was such intense pain, all he could think to do, his cognitive evaluative self, I'm not too sure it was the cognitive self or the motivational self, picked up his nail gun and shot nails into his skull to try to minimize the pain in his wrist. Well, you can almost imagine that happening, but guess what? It really did happen. The paramedics came to the site. They were able to sew on the hand. He had good use of his hand, but brain surgeons couldn't remove all of the nails because they were hitting some very crucial spots in his brain. So that's a definition of an example of perpetual dominance. Pain threshold is the point where the stimulus is perceived as pain. That really doesn't differ from patient to patient, but what does differ is the pain tolerance. That's the intensity of pain that we experience before we cry uncle or before we want something done. And again, the things that will influence those behaviors will be our cultural experiences, the expectations that we have of ourselves, our role behaviors, our general physical and mental health. What decreases that pain tolerance, and this is important to understand because we can help ourselves by increasing our pain tolerance. So what decreases it is more pain exposure, fatigue, anger, boredom, sleep deprivation. People in pain are often angry. And that is only intensifying their experience of pain. Increased pain tolerance can be increased by alcohol. I'm not recommending that we go out and start drinking, but it is increased by alcohol, medication, hypnosis, warmth, distraction, and strong beliefs in religion or strong faith beliefs. Let's go to the next slide. So the biopsychosocial model is really epitomized or demonstrated in what I just talked to you about as the experience of pain and how our brain receives that experience of pain. So psychological and environmental factors can be associated with pain intensity and interference with pain function. And this has been brought out by research studies that look at perceived social support increasing the ability to tolerate pain. Our pain beliefs, which is the meaning that we give to pain, our pain coping strategies, and our pain catastrophizing. So let me just go back and talk about pain beliefs briefly. So our belief that pain could cause physical harm is detrimental to our experience of pain, because that's going to intensify. If we think pain is going to cause physical harm, and so we keep ourselves from anything, like we put ourselves to bed, that's just going to intensify the experience of pain. Pain catastrophizing, what does that mean? That's focusing on the pain. That's pain, seeing pain as a horrible, awful, or unbearable, kind of ruminating on that pain, like, I can't stand this, I'm never going to get better, it's never going to be any different, and nothing's going to help. That's catastrophizing. It's the worst. In fact, I had a patient in my office yesterday who said, you know, I'm not suicidal, but I think if I have to put up with this another minute, I might consider doing away with my life. And I just felt terrible. I mean, awfully terrible. But she was catastrophizing. It was the end. I mean, it was like there's no other. It's jumping off the bridge or nothing. Now, that probably happens, and that's probably very, very real. But pain catastrophizing doesn't have to happen, and we can remodel our thinking. So let's go to pain coping. You know, how can we influence? How can we cope? How do our thoughts influence what we do and how we cope? So I have about 20 minutes left, and let me go through these slides. I want to give you these because these are probably the most important. Cognitive restructuring. How can we recognize maladaptive thinking and in place put adaptive thinking? So maladaptive thinking is that pain catastrophizing. It's focusing on and ruminating. It's disabling beliefs, like the belief that pain is going to be disabling, that you're never going to get on top of it, belief that pain is going to harm, belief that only cure is going to be medical or medicine or pills, and that cure is only in the hands of your doctor, that you don't have anything to do with the pain, that the pain can only be helped by the doctor, and that analgesics are the only appropriate mechanism for managing pain. And another interesting maladaptive pain thought is that folks may feel that their family members need to be particularly solicitous to them when they're experiencing pain, because it's overwhelming, because they can do nothing about it. And because the tiptoeing around of family and the extra strokes that a family can give may be very important. And those are actually maladaptive behaviors, thinking that it's the family and not you that's in charge of your pain. Because guess what? It's you that is in charge of your pain. And it's only you that can do something about your pain. You're in charge of your health care. You're in charge of how you feel. You know, and you know why that's real? Because when you leave the doctor's office, that woman or man doesn't come with you into your home. It's you, baby, all by yourself, managing all by yourself. Now, the physician is going to give you tools, but it's not going to be with you 24/7 to help you manage pain. New adaptive behaviors. And the rest of the slide says rest and relaxation, some exercise, acceptance of pain. That's really an interesting thought, acceptance, giving up the struggle against direct control over pain and the decide that you can focus and engage on some other valued activities. That's what acceptance will do, giving up that control, just saying, you know, I'm probably going to have this pain. It's going to maybe be with me for the rest of my life, but I'm going to do the best I can to manage it. I'm going to be the one that is going to be on top of this pain. Reinterpreting pain sensations, the burning, thinking of it as warmth, and going through some coping self-talk, positive thoughts, feeding yourself positive thoughts. Things could be worse. Things will get better. building self-efficacy for coping with pain. So I'm going to be, the next couple of slides are actually probably repeats of some of the things I've said already. So belief that the objective evidence of disease is required for pain to be real, that's a disabling belief. The next slide talks about these disabling beliefs, that the provider is the expert, that the helpless person with the pain is a victim, expecting that urgent pain relief is the major goal right now. If I can't get rid of this pain relief, I might have to jump off the Brooklyn Bridge, or if I can't get pain relief. And viewing pain as the only problem, really self-evaluation of what else is going on in my life. Do I have the right amount of social support? Do I have the right kind of social support? Do I have someone who's willing to hug me, Do I have someone who will hug me or can hug me? Do I have someone around who can hug me? Do I have a friend to call that I can come up over right now and give me a hug? So thoughts of catastrophizing, our pain beliefs, our self-efficacy, I really did talk about those. So recognizing, and I started to discuss this, this is the next slide, depression. People who are depressed are less likely to engage in self-management of pain. High anxiety or fear of pain. You have that trigeminal pain. That's really, really intense. So fear of that, of when that pain's going to happen again. Not having good self-talk in place or good modalities in place to manage that pain will just increase the fear. High levels of pain interference are going to happen with our sleep, with our relationships, physical activities, etc. So there are benefits to cognitive behavioral therapy, and we're going to discuss that in the next slide. So building those self-management skills, what is that about? So allowing some pain some of the time, that's the acceptance. Thinking and doing, willingness to experience pain. Like I said, this is going to happen. Maybe I'm going to have some of this pain. But then engaging in life, not going back to bed, not expecting your family to wait on you because you've got pain, saying to yourself, yep, I can get out of bed. I can even get out of my house. I can figure out how to get to the pool and swim a lap. Engaging in some mindfulness activities, and I will discuss what mindfulness is. It's a non-judgmental awareness of pain. That's what the slide says, but what it really means is it is a relaxation technique that's almost a hypnosis where you are just focusing on that pain exclusively, focusing on the feelings and the emotional experience of pain, and believing that the pain reduction is not just the central goal, but the central goal is to come in tune with your emotions. And by coming in tune, you may discover other emotions that you have. Let's go to pain acceptance. We did talk about that being related to a positive adjustment, that pain intensity and psychological distress is associated with less pain acceptance, that greater pain acceptance is associated with task persistence, physical functioning, general mental well-being, self-efficacy, motivation, engaging in life, and that acceptance and concomitant therapy called ACT is a pain acceptance modality that you can do with a therapist, and you probably need to look someone up that can help you through that. Mindfulness-based interventions, again, we'll talk about that specifically in a bit. I have about 15 minutes, and I think I can manage to get through the slides. The cognitive behavioral therapy, the therapeutic objective is to increase mastery and control over fear, anxiety, to reduce your stress, and reduce environmental triggers. Cognitive behavioral therapy is done with a therapist. It's based on the theory, a cognitive behavioral theory of pain, in which thoughts and behavioral response to pain influence adjustment and functioning. So some of the cognitive behavioral therapy includes relaxation training, cognitive therapy, behavioral strategies such as pacing yourself, coping strategies and activation. Specific to pacing is maintaining an appropriate level of activity despite the pain you're experiencing. Hypnosis. Hypnosis can be done on your own. There are tapes and books that you can get. Hypnosis is a modality that has been utilized in multiple sclerosis pain through these studies of hypnosis, it's recognized that pain can be reduced, the intensity of pain can be reduced in folks that use hypnosis, and it has a lasting effect of up to 3 months from one hypnosis treatment. Amazing, right? You're already on board. So it's a relaxation. It's kind of focusing your attention. You can commonly do it with a provider who works on hypnosis, or you can train yourself. It's the here and now. So right away, what happens when I introduce this concept to patients is said, oh, I've tried that, and I can't be hypnotized. Well, you can if you want to be. You can relax. Now, whether you go into another state or a hypnotic state is not really the point. The point is, can you relax and start focusing your attention on your pain and then focusing your attention on other rich imaginative experiences? So focusing on attention on pain helps then recognize other emotions, as I said before, and then brings yourself to another place of understanding how to control pain. So let's go on to the next slide, encouraging behavior activation. This is real, and this is an important way of treating your pain, and it means increasing physical activity, increasing activities that are enjoyable and meaningful and pleasurable. And you know what? That's the goal. It's not getting rid of your pain. It's increasing your enjoyment and meaning in life, and participation in activities that are consistent with your values and goals. Is that going increasing your spirituality? Is that going to church? Is it increasing your relationship? Is it getting in touch with your significant other and say, hey, let's go out to lunch together? Now, the next slide is going to talk about activity pacing and goal setting. So it's a systematic. It's not going and riding your bike for an hour. Nope, it's doing it for 1 or 2 minutes and then systematically increasing it. Activity scheduling and pacing yourself and having attainable goals. So the next slide talks about implementing these goals by providing tools and worksheets. And I'm going to go to the next slide, which is a worksheet. You can download this and type it up and fill it in. And it says, I will do something for a certain period of time each day or on certain days of the week. So it's a contract with yourself. Let's go to the next slide, which is encouraging the use of relaxation skills. You can do it through breathing, imagery, imagining yourself on a beach and the waves going in and out. It can be progressive muscle relaxation where you start with your toes and you tighten them and relax them. And if you can't physically tighten them because you can't physically tell your feet to move, imagine it tightening and relaxing. Imagine your calves relaxing and tightening and just go progressively up to your shoulders. You know, if you just right now sat there while you're listening to me and just let your tongue fall back in your mouth, and let your jaw drop. That's really relaxing, isn't it? And then, of course, self-hypnosis. So relaxation implementation, again, on that next slide, provides a rationale for its use in pain. It's been utilized in research studies and has been thought to be very efficacious. So then our following slide is considering mindfulness, and I've talked about mindfulness, and it's a non-judgmental awareness, acceptance of the present moment and any feelings and sensations and thoughts that might arise, and interventions. Let's go to the next couple of slides because they're the last few slides and I've got 10 minutes of time. I do want to get to pharmacological management for neuropathic pain because I know you've talked about that. That's usually the first modality rather than self-management that's used. You can use topical agents. I talked about the red hot peppers. That's an over-the-counter modality or pain management. It's capsaicin. And you can rub that on lightly. Remember to try to do it with gloves. Don't touch your eyes. It's very hot. And use the lower dose, not the high dose. Everyone thinks that more is better. Everyone thinks that the high dose is going to be, because absolutely my pain is really intense, so I need the highest dose. But you know what? You might have a rebound worsening. Start out with a low dose, which I think is 0.025%. So look at your glove drugstore shelf. Membrane stabilizing agents, dorsal horn inhibiting agents, non-methyl D aspartate antagonists, modulating agents and antispasticity medications. The medications you see here are all put under mechanism of action. So you can choose a medication from those different categories to manage your pain with low doses from different categories. So use more than one modality at low doses, acquiring lower side effects. Always start low with these medications and work up over days and weeks. How long have you been living with this pain? Years? Absolutely. So don't start high. Go slow and go long. Go out long. You've had the pain for a long time. Give yourself a chance to acclimatize or get used to the side effects. Begin to tolerate the side effects because all these drugs have side effects. Let's go to the next slide, please. That next slide is recommendations for the treatment of trigeminal neuralgia that is supported by the International Association for the Study of Pain. So when they say level A recommendation, they mean that this is an FDA-approved indication for TN, or trigeminal neuralgia. It has been seen that in randomized, placebo-controlled clinical trials that this works. It's first line. Oxcarbazepine, which is the little brother to carbamazepine, is also first line. Getting a B rating, though, and B only means that it may not have been placebo-controlled, that may have not been randomized. Lamotrigine is a class 1 study. Baclofen. So these four drugs have been utilized in studies for the management of trigeminal neuralgia. Other options can be phenytoin, clonazepam, valproic acid, pregabalin, gabapentin, but they are not as effective, believe me, as the ones you see on here, an intranasal lidocaine. People have used lidocaine patches for trigeminal pain. Let's go to the next slide. These are treatments for continuous neuropathic pain, painful extremity dysesthesias. The evidence for this is from the International Association for the Study of Pain, amitriptyline, gabapentin, pregabalin. These are the aching on top of your foot, the burning pain. Gabapentin is really good for this. Gabapentin is vitamin G. Everybody's on it. Everybody's on it for everything. Pregabalin. That was a joke. I didn't mean to be irreverent, but it's pretty commonly used. So 800 milligrams to 3,600 milligrams. If you're over 3,600 milligrams, it's just like putting a sponge on a big puddle of water. The pores of that sponge have soaked up all the water, meaning you as a person have soaked up all the drug you can, and the rest of it's just lying there on the counter. The rest of the drug is not being utilized by the body. So over 3,600 milligrams is probably moot. You're not getting much benefit and using a lot of money to pay for it. Okay, let's go to the next pain. Opioids, when are we using them? For moderate to severe pain, where it's had a significant impact on your life. It has a place, but frankly, in clinical studies of MS pain, opioids have had a very negligible use and not much efficacy. They have. We do use them. I do want you to understand that opioids need to be, the side effects need to be managed, especially the constipation and the slow motility of the bowel that can occur with opioid use. Opioid hyperanalgesia is a problem, meaning that opioids may turn on your body to experience more pain. So the more you're on opioids, obviously you build a tolerance to them and you need more. That's commonly seen. But opioids may actually cause a hyperalgesia, meaning more pain can occur because of the opioids. The opioids downregulate neurotransmitters, or they may upregulate sensitive neurotransmitters to pain. So drug recommendations on the next slide. Start at a low dose and increase to titrate to efficacy. If you've got partial pain relief with one drug, a combination of two or more may actually yield better results with fewer side effects. In general, if you've been absolutely pain-free for 3 months, taper off. You don't have to be on these drugs for life. The following slide talks about psychological and physical agents. You can read those over. There are surgical agents for trigeminal neuralgia, and Gamma Knife has been tried and true in several studies, but a very recent study of several of the mechanisms for surgical intervention to relieve trigeminal neuralgia, such as percutaneous balloon rhizotomy or microvascular decompression or Gamma Knife surgery, and it's not a knife, and it's not really surgery. It's a cobalt radiation to the pons to put a little bit of a lesion on that pons to stop the pain wildfiring that occurs in trigeminal neuralgia, but that there was really no difference in how they affected pain. Percutaneous rhizotomy along with gamma knife was more long-lasting than any of them by themselves. Percutaneous balloon rhizotomy and micular vascular decompression had greater side effects of facial numbness. So that's enough on that. Let's talk about cannabinoids or marijuana in MS. So there have been a lot of class one evidence to show that there is benefit of the mucosal delivery, that's Sativex, in spasticity, pain, and sleep. So the International Association of Pain, remember that's international, and these studies were done in Britain and Canada, showed that there was class one evidence. Side effects they thought were mild. The cannabinoids may have a potential neuroprotective effect. They may potentially slow the progression of disease. Now, these studies are being done as we speak of cannabinoids on cannabinoid receptors in multiple sclerosis. Could they be disease-modifying therapies? Maybe, but we have to deal with the psychotropic effects. So on the next slide, the recommendations of this one, this meta-analysis was that the symptoms interact with disability from the patient perspective. Remember, this is patient report. They felt their symptoms were less when they had the Sativex. There were problems with the clinical design because you couldn't always have a placebo group. The people knew what they were taking, so there wasn't a placebo. The psychoactive results were a problem. So let's look at the next slide. The side effects are dry mouth, dizziness, nausea, intoxication, and somnolence. Cannabinoids were about as effective as codeine. So the THC was about as effective as codeine. The conclusion is, though, that it's modest treatment effects, modest, and considered as an add-on drug. There are mild adverse effects. It's well-tolerated, but it's uncertain for long-term use because we don't know what the long-term use of an intoxicant can do. We have two studies that just came out. One of them is not on this slide because I didn't have a chance to add it. It came out in May, and it was a large Canadian study of smoked cannabis. And Americans always say, hey, what's this about? We smoke our cannabis. We don't take it by mouth or by spray. 162 million people are smoking marijuana in the world. About 16% of patients with MS are smoking marijuana in Canada and the United States to manage their pain. Oh, not just pain, other side effects, spasticity, bladder, tremor. Tremor is another one. But what are the neuropsychological deficits that can happen with inhaled cannabis? So this Canadian study saw that folks with inhaled cannabis had much worse outcomes on neurocognitive testing. And that also was brought to bear in a large study of smoked cannabis that was published in Neurology in 2011 that saw that cannabis users were twice as likely to be globally cognitively impaired, not during their cannabis use, but far after it. The side effects of cannabis is on your cognition. Please be cautious. Please realize that brain is important, and you want to save that brain. So you know what? I have about 2 minutes. Oh, my golly. The most common CAM use for pain is acupuncture, reflexology, massage, and chiropractic. Make sure that you know what you're getting into when you use complementary and alternative medicines. I actually think that it's fine, but make sure that you're not paying for something that isn't really quite effective. Look at the National Institutes of Health has a CAM website where they do studies on CAM products. So look that up. In summary, keep a pain diary. Own your pain. Talk about your pain at each doctor visit. Bring your diary with you. Talk about all the alternative medicines you're using. Talk about how pain is affecting your mood, your sleep, your relationships, your ability to work and play. Are you having any side effects? They definitely need to be managed. What's your self-talk? What are your coping strategies? Please go home tonight and evaluate what they are. The next slide is just websites for you to look at, and I leave you as the last slide with my best definition of health because, my golly, it has nothing to do with pain. It has nothing to do with MS. It says health is the state of being in which an individual does the best with the capacity that he has and acts in a way to maximize that capacity. And resilience, This is Elizabeth Edwards now. Resilience is accepting a new reality. And I leave you with that, those wise words. Thank you for listening.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Dr. Maloney. This was so much information and all of it really, really interesting and educational. I'm only going to ask you one question before we go, since we are already at 8:01. A pretty common question that I do hear from folks, and actually that somebody posted on our little chat box too that unfortunately you can't see, is that pain seems to be really misunderstood by a lot of doctors. And so is there a way that you can talk to your neurologist about your pain, maybe especially if your neurologist isn't an MS specialist and it's just maybe a general practice neurologist or even a general practitioner? Is there a way you can bring up pain as it relates to multiple sclerosis in a way that would be really beneficial to them, you know, interacting with the doctor?
That's a great question, Alicia. Absolutely. And it should be done first. You know, when you come to the neurologist, typically pain isn't your biggest problem. Usually it's your bladder or your walking. And the whole 15 minutes with that neurologist is taken up talking about walking. And he says, well, I don't have time for this. And, you know, that's exactly right. Neurologists may not have time. You may call up and say, I would like to have an office visit to talk about my pain. And then bring with you the real specifics about your pain, that old cart. Look at these slides, and if you don't have them, utilize them to help you frame your discussion so that you can get a lot said in that 15 minutes. And you may even ask for a longer discussion, and you may even ask for a referral to a pain specialist. Because you need pain takes time, and you're absolutely right. Pain is not understood, and it's frankly pushed aside because it does take time. And the general neurologist may feel a couple of things. They may feel, gosh, I'm not an expert. I don't have enough background to understand how to manage pain. And they may get panicked because they think, oh, whoa, this is going to take a long time to discuss this. And they may say the patient's going to put up a lot of barriers to the things I suggest. Or the neurologist may just want to throw medications, and, you know, that's okay, but it's not the only way, as you've learned tonight, to manage your pain. There's a lot of ways. So that's great, and I know I don't have time to really get into it, but look at these slides and be prepared to talk about it through an educated way by writing down your pain experience.
Absolutely. The other thing I might recommend, too, is if your doctor doesn't understand pain and multiple sclerosis, the National MS Society has some really great professional resources that are available to our neurologists and to people like you, Dr. Maloney, who work with people living with multiple sclerosis. So if your doctor needs more information, you can always call and request these professional papers that we've put together, and you can bring that into your doctor so that it gives them a jumping-off point. It gives them some place to start and another place where they can get some additional information if they need more information as well. So I would definitely recommend that as well. If you call our 1-800 number, which is 1-800-344-4867, then you can also ask to get one of these professional papers for the neurologist as well. So I think, unfortunately, we've reached the end of our evening, but Dr. Maloney, this was really wonderful, and I want to thank you again so much. For those folks that are still on the line, if for some reason you didn't get your question answered and you really would like to ask it, I would invite you to please email me at Alicia, Alicia.Baron, Barron, @NMSS, Nancy Mary Samsam, .org. That's my email address. Or you can always call the National MS Society at that 800 number, 1-800-344-4867. And you can ask them to either connect you with me, Alicia Baron, or you can ask them to send me a little note that has your question. And Dr. Maloney has been kind enough to offer to answer some of our questions and to help me answer these questions for you guys. So if you have any questions that didn't get answered, please give me an email or give us a call at the National MS. So this concludes our teleconference for tonight. Thank you all again so much for joining us. It's been such a pleasure. And the slides and the recording of the teleconference will be available on the National MS Society, the South Central Region's website. So that would be the Texas website, Louisiana, New Mexico, Arkansas, and Oklahoma's website. So for those of you who joined us from out of state, that's where you can look for this recording, and it will be posted within about probably the next few weeks. So thanks so much, everyone. Have a wonderful evening.
Thank you.